People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. The National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA, was enacted by Congress in 1935. It was hailed at that time as the Magna Carta of American labor. In the 1930s, workers began to organize militantly. A great strike wave in 1933 and 34 included citywide general strikes and factory takeovers. Violent confrontations occurred between workers trying to form unions and the police and private security forces defending the interests of anti-union employers. Some historians believe that Congress adopted the NLRA primarily in the hopes of averting greater, possibly revolutionary, labor unrest. An increasing number of labor leaders are claiming that the NLRA is actually hurting the efforts of unions to organize and blocking working people from attaining economic justice. One of those is Professor of Law Jim Pope from Rutgers University.
Over the years, the protections have been whittled away, and corporations have figured out how to turn the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act against workers, so that now the law actually inhibits workers from exercising their rights to organize and strike.
Another is Ed Bruno, co-chair of the Workers' Rights Campaign for the Labor Party.
If you cannot effectively negotiate your conditions of employment, then you are, in fact, in a condition of involuntary servitude.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. The Labor Party held its political convention in Washington, D.C. this last July. Convention delegates voted to move forward with the Labor Party's programs, which include just health care, the right to a job at a living wage, and workers' rights. One of the topics garnering increasing attention is the National Labor Relations Act. When it was passed in 1935 by the United States Congress, the National Labor Relations Act was heralded as the Magna Carta of labor. But is the NLRA now actually hurting workers? More and more people are saying yes. Jim Pope is a professor of law at Rutgers University. He was interviewed by PTR correspondent David Apsey at the Labor Party convention in Washington, D.C.
The National Labor Relations Act is the basic law that governs workers' rights to organize unions in the United States. It was passed in 1935, and at that time, it was a big victory for working people. Because before that time, they had no right under federal law whatsoever to organize or strike, protest in any way. Now, what's happened over the years, however, is that whereas in 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, the labor movement was very mobilized and powerful and able to take advantage of this law and use it effectively, over the years, the protections have been whittled away, and corporations have figured out how to turn the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act against workers so that now the law actually inhibits workers from exercising their rights to organize and strike. How this happened, in a word, there was, of course, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1946, which took away many protections of the National Labor Relations Act had offered, and also outlawed workers supporting each other. And I want to give you an example of that because I think this is of central importance. It helps to explain why it's so hard for workers to organize today. And that is that before the Taft-Hartley Act, if an employer fired workers for organizing, other unions could support the workers at that employer's facility by refusing to handle its products. So, for example, let's say an employer like Walmart fires, which Walmart does all the time, discriminates against an employee who wants to organize a union at that store, then the employees at that store might ask the truckers not to transport Walmart products, or might ask workers at other facilities that have to that produce products for Walmart not to produce products for Walmart. In 1946, the Taft-Hartley Act prohibited all that, so that employees at other employers are basically forced to assist Walmart in denying workers their rights, to assist Walmart in continuing to make a profit in spite of the fact that Walmart is violating the workers' right to organize by discriminating against people who want to organize a union.
So Taft-Hartley was sort of an amendment to the NLRA? Or
part of the Taft-Hartley Act was a set of amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, and that was one of them.
Professor Pope addressed the issue of political activity.
One terrible problem over the years since Taft-Hartley is that ordinary political activity, like lobbying, contributing money to political candidates, has proven to be totally ineffective at winning labor law reform. Unfortunately, there's a reason for this that is extremely unlikely to disappear. And that reason is that both major parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, receive more money from corporations and very wealthy individuals than they do from unions. The Democrats receive a lot of money from unions and working people, but it's still not nearly as much as the Democrats receive from corporations and the wealthy. So that what you have is you have a Republican Party that knows exactly what it's doing. Its money is coming from the same source as its votes. It's aggressive about pursuing its agenda. And meanwhile, you have a Democratic Party that's getting its votes from one constituency and its money from another constituency. And that's why the Democrats always seem to be waffling, while the Republicans are confidently moving forward because their votes and their money are coming from the same source.
What results, then, is for all intents and purposes a one-party political system?
It is when the corporations are united. And they aren't always united, which is why ordinary people can win some victories. They can ally with some corporations against other corporations. But when all the corporations line up on the same side of an issue, which is true with workers' rights, it's one kind of issue where they line up together, and there have been statistical studies of this. For example, on minimum wage, not all corporations always line up the same on that, and that's one reason why we still have a minimum wage and occasionally even can raise it. But on an issue like workers' rights, they always line up, and there have been no real victories, significant victories in workers' rights for decades at the national level.
You're listening to People's Tribune Radio, our topic, the National Labor Relations Act. Later, we'll hear from co-chair of the Labor Party's Workers' Rights Campaign, Ed Bruno. But first, we continue with Jim Pope, professor of law at Rutgers University. He was interviewed by People's Tribune Radio correspondent David Apsey.
What other tactics can be used then by the workers to either amend laws or make their own kind of laws?
I don't claim to be an expert on this. I'm sitting in a university with a tenured job, and I'm not taking the kind of risks that working people would have to take, I think, to fight this kind of denial of workers' rights that's going on. What I can say is that in the past, before the National Labor Relations Act, the labor movement had an approach toward this problem that did prove successful in those times. And those times had some similarities to our times now, in that employers felt free to discharge workers for organizing, and the government was really providing no effective assistance. The approach that the labor movement took in those days, and it was the approach of people as far apart as Samuel Gompers, who's known as a very conservative business unionist, and John L. Lewis, on the other hand, who in the later stages of his career became a militant advocate of industrial unionism. They took the position that workers enjoyed constitutional rights to organize, to strike, and to act in solidarity under the First and 13th Amendments to the United States Constitution. Unions and workers went out and exercised those rights in spite of the fact that at the time that meant they were risking discharge by employers, injunctions from courts, potentially imprisonment, and even violent retaliation from vigilantes and government troops. I'm not in a position to recommend that anybody go out and take those risks. All I can say is that, in my opinion, workers are justified if they decide to take such risks. Recently, we had a teacher strike in New Jersey where teachers went out on strike in spite of state law that said that public employee strikes were illegal. They were railroaded in court, in my opinion. They were ordered back to work. And if you listen carefully to what they said, without the benefit of any legal instruction on their constitutional rights, they said they believed that what they were doing was right, that the school district should not have the right to dictate their terms and conditions of employment with no consent from them. And I think it's that sentiment that comes out sometimes in struggles like the one in, with the New Jersey teachers that that can serve as a focal point, perhaps, for calling attention to these abuses.
The section of the 13th Amendment you're talking about is that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist in the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. How is infringing on the rights to organize involuntary servitude?
What I'm going to give you is basically the argument that Sam Gompers and John L. Lewis used years ago, which to me seems equally valid today. If you're working for a corporation and you do not have the right to organize, to strike, or to act in solidarity, you have no power. You can be fired for any reason or no reason at all. You have to be in a constant fear, and this is, you know, polls show this. Most American workers in polls say they believe that if they speak up to try to organize a union, they're going to get fired or otherwise discriminated against. You have no power, no effective voice, and so you're in a condition of servitude. On which I could say just parenthetically that the law used to not mince words about this. Labor law used to be called master and servant law. Now it's been sanitized, and it's called employment law. But they used to understand that that's exactly what it was, and the definition of an employee was the employee was a person who had to follow the orders of the master. Now, you might say, well, how can this possibly be involuntary servitude, given that you can quit your job? You can quit your job and do something else, so it seems like it would be voluntary. Well, not if the only other thing you can do is go get another job, and then on that other job, you don't have the rights to organize, to strike, to act in solidarity. Because once again, if you don't have those rights, you're not going to have any power. You're going to be right back in a relation of servitude, so that the right to quit really boils down to a right to choose your master, but you can't choose to get out of a condition of servitude. That's the argument in brief. And of course, as with any legal argument, there are many, many ramifications of that, and we have a paper that tries to address those. The Labor Party, and again, I'm probably not the best person to ask this question of, because my involvement has been very much focused on this workers' rights project, and there are other people who have a much better understanding of the overall role of the party. But in terms of workers' rights, I think that the party can help to revive within the labor movement the tradition that existed before the Taft-Hartley Act, where workers and unions can take their own position on what the Constitution says. It means going back to the basic reason why we have a written Constitution, which is that you can read the Constitution. Everybody can read the Constitution, not just judges. And if you look at the way that constitutional rights have come into being, they have not come into being because of judges. If you look at the First Amendment, it wasn't even enforced until the 1920s, and not really enforced until even later than that. The reason being that it wasn't until the 20th century that people began stepping forward, reading the First Amendment for themselves and saying, we believe we have the right to free speech, and standing up and exercising that right, challenging the courts to take seriously the freedom of speech. And it took decades of that kind of activity, and people were getting thrown in jail merely for making speeches on street corners before the Supreme Court finally scratched its head and said, gee, maybe it really does mean free speech there in the First Amendment. And I think the process for workers' rights, really, it's already been through once, culminating in the initial enactment of the NLRA, which purports to protect the right to organize. It's eroded away over the intervening years, and now I think the Labor Party can play a role in reviving that kind of spirit that workers and unions can read the Constitution for themselves and exercise their rights.
Jim Pope, professor of law at Rutgers University, spoke with PT radio correspondent David Apsey at the Labor Party convention held in Washington, D.C. this past July. You are listening to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we're looking at the National Labor Relations Act and workers' rights. The Labor Party has several campaigns that it's working on, one of those being workers' rights. Ed Bruno co-chairs the Workers' Rights Campaign for the Labor Party. He also spoke with David Apsey at the Labor Party convention in Washington, D.C. Ed Bruno.
The experience of those of us who have been trying to organize unions for the last 30 years is fundamentally that the law has such an imbalance built right into it that when people are fired for exercising what ought to be their rights, nothing much happens except these long, drawn-out proceedings and investigations and judicial administrative hearings and so forth. But when workers do something that is effective, let's say have a picket line that actually stops the operation of a company, then the board acts immediately and there's injunctions and if you persist, there's police. So that embedded right in the core of the law is the problem that the law really is about regulating the free flow of commerce, and it's not really about the rights of workers. So it starts with the idea that business should not be interrupted, and that consequently certain rights should be accorded to working people in the interest of not interrupting business. So consequently, you don't get anywhere near the urgency. If you're simply fired because you want to have a form an association or bargain a contract, there's no urgency there because there's no interruption with business. And so that the imbalance is really the source of why the law can't work.
The law seemed to be a victory when it was passed in, 1935?
And in fact, it was. I mean, we got to look at this. Is you have to have a clear-eyed view of history here. And a lot of people sometimes they think, well, the law was the cause of the upsurge in industrial unionism, you know, the CIO and so forth. That's not true. On the other hand, other people say, well, the law had nothing to do with the upsurge in union organization. That's not true either. And if you look very carefully at the history of my own union, the UE, and steel and auto, rubber, packing house, and the CIO in general, you'll find, in fact, that the breakthrough in organization had to do with the sit-downs in 1937 when the law was not in effect. And that was the breakthrough, and there was 5 months of sit-down strikes all over the country, and that established the unions not in a majority position, but in a minority position. On the other hand, the second breakthrough came roughly in 39 to 41, and then the aggressive enforcement of the Wagner Act by the brand new NLRB was crucial. And they were, as an example, the brand new NLRB, which then was on the side of working people, returned 7,000 fired workers to just the Ford River Rouge plant alone. And of course that solidified the union at Ford. So that the law, you got to be very careful and draw the lessons from what happened in this Wagner Act.
Could you explain what the Wagner Act is and how did the Wagner Act affect NLRA?
Well, the Wagner Act is the NLRA. The Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act is the name of it is the Wagner Act after Senator Wagner. But you know, again, without making a big deal out of it, there was a long period of time when people tried to figure out how to bring some measure of democracy to the workplace, particularly the industrial workplace, which had no unions and no collective bargaining. And from a variety of events that happened in the New Deal days, the culmination of that was the Wagner Act, which we call the National Labor Relations Act, which created then the National Labor Relations Board. The thing I think that's vital to remember is the act was made constitutional in 1937. By 1938, the Supreme Court had already wiped out fundamentally the most important part of the act, which was that the Supreme Court ruled that even though the act said people have the right to strike, the Supreme Court said, but you can be replaced in the interest of the uninterrupted flow of business. So, you know, we've gone through the Supreme Court stuff a couple times, most recently in Florida. You know, they put a judicial interpretation on rights as they see them, depending on their class position. And as far as I know, there's no workers on the Supreme Court. Remember, the Wagner Act was based on the free flow of commerce, leaving itself open, therefore, to the Supreme Court to say, in the interest of free flow of commerce, strikers are to be able to be replaced by business so that business can operate. Our position today in the Labor Party is we've got to rethink this whole question and place those rights squarely on the Constitution so that the Supreme Court has a much more difficult time, or any court, in overthrowing workers' rights.
So now you're going to proceed from the position of the First and 13th Amendments is constitutionally protected protections of freedom of speech, which gives you right to organize,
yes.
And 13th Amendment, freedom from involuntary servitude. Can you expand on this?
Well, the 13th is crucial to this thinking, where you know people aren't going to be used to this problem because we don't think very much about the 13th except in terms of slavery. But it's always been labor's position, at least up until the New Deal days, that to have effective rights of association and to effectively bargain, you have to be able to peacefully engage in things like strikes, sympathy, boycotts, and a whole variety of things that people should have a perfect right to do, and mostly in other countries do have a right to do. That's when the 13th becomes important. If you cannot effectively negotiate your conditions of employment, then you are, in fact, in a condition of involuntary servitude. And that was labor's position from the early 1900s, well into the New Deal. And then, of course, the CIO and the Wagner Act changed that for a while. But as we know, people cannot engage in collective bargaining today. They're not free to do so. They're not free to act in solidarity. So we think it's probably time to look back at our history and pick up that particular piece of constitutional rights as opposed to regulations.
So what strategies can be enacted by the working people to bring the program of the working people to the forefront here?
That is a $64 question. Right? This isn't going to be a very sexy answer, but I'll use myself as an example. I mean, I was a former director of organization of a pretty aggressive union, the UE, which aggressively organizes, and I'm in my mid-50s. And I'm only coming to this understanding of where the problems lie and how we envision our rights now. And part of this problem is my generation of trade union activists have lived our entire life under the NLRA, and we really don't know any better. We think that's the way it is, and things have really gone into decline for working people, and we can't quite figure out parts of the parts of the elements that would be needed for a revival. So consequently, our thinking is that we really don't have any business going to allies and so forth until we in the trade union movement get our own thinking straight on this question. So we're spending a lot of time talking to those trade unionists, particularly those who are in charge of organizing, bargaining, organizing strikes and so forth, about recapturing this history and then making an analysis of what that would mean for how we act. And we think we got to get our own house in order, so to speak, or at least a part of our own house, before we can give really significant public voice to this. So it's a lot of, it's not exactly underground work, but it's a lot of, it's a lot of talking, a lot of discussing, a lot of thinking about our own experiences, what we can learn from them, and so forth. This is really a vital role for the Labor Party because it's here. It provides the format in which we can first of all develop this analysis and get people to help us with looking at our own history, and then the party, because it. It isn't one sector or just one union or something can bring this to a cross-union audience, and that becomes crucial.
Ed Bruno, member of the United Electrical Workers Union and co-chair of the Labor Party's Workers' Rights Campaign. He spoke with People's Tribune radio correspondent David Apsey at the Labor Party's National Convention held in Washington, D.C. this past July. If you'd like more information about the Labor Party and the party's campaigns, you can check them out on the internet at www.thelaborparty.com. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with social and economic justice for all. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888. 1-800-691-6888 or on the internet at www.lrna.org. Special thanks to People's Tribune Radio correspondent David Apsey for his contributions to today's program. This edition of People's Tribune Radio was made possible in part with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and KVMR-FM Radio. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.